WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
Our next guest, Dee Rees, directed the film Mudbound, which has earned 4 Academy Award nominations, including one for its screenplay, which was co-written by Rees and Virgil Williams. The other nominations are for Cinematography, Best Original Song, and for Mary J. Blige as Best Supporting Actress. Mudbound, adapted from Hilary Jordan's novel of the same name, is about two families in the segregated Mississippi Delta just before, during, and after World War II. The African-American family are poor sharecroppers. The white family owns their land, but they're also struggling. Each family has a member who goes off to fight in the war. The white soldier returns emotionally devastated. The black soldier returns to find that although he helped liberate Europe, back home in Mississippi, he has no rights. Here's a scene in which the returning black soldier, Ronzel, played by Jason Mitchell, is shopping in the general store. He's still in uniform, but when he leaves the store by the front door, he's confronted by a couple of white men. One is played by Jason Clark, the other by Jonathan Banks, who speaks first.
You use the back door.
Go on, son. Son, we don't want no trouble here. Go on. Go on.
You know what? You're absolutely right. When we was overseas, they didn't make us use the back door. General Patton put us on the front line. Yes, sir. And you know what we did? We kicked the hell out of Hitler and them Jerrys. Are y'all at home safe and sound?
Mudbound director and co-writer Dee Rees also directed HBO's Bessie, a drama about Bessie Smith, and the film Pariah, about a 17-year-old African-American girl coming out and dealing with the resulting complications in her life. Terry interviewed Dee Rees last November.
Dee Rees, welcome to Fresh Air. You know, some of the story is about the kind of overt racism in Mississippi during and after the war, World War II. There's some really horrible things that happen in the film without giving anything away. Did this film have a different meaning for you after Charlottesville? The film was probably completed by then. But, you know, the march in Charlottesville, like, that's the kind of, like, overt racism that people had, you know, more or less stopped expressing in marches and big marches. And to see that was really just, like, shocking and horrifying to so many Americans.
Yeah, I think Charlottesville was shocking for some, but it wasn't for me or for my family. I mean, because I grew up in 1980s Nashville. I grew up next to a Klan member. Like, everyone knew he was a Klan member. My dad was a cop, you know, and I grew up 3 houses down from people who used Confederate flags as curtains. I remember one summer I played, like, with the granddaughter of this known Klan member. Like, all summer we caught cicadas. And we had grown close, and so it was, like, time for a birthday party. And I said, oh, like, what time do I come for your party? And she's like, oh, no, you can't come to my house because my parents don't like black people. So it was this thing where, you know, even though we're 2 kids playing all along, like, still, like, this thing is, like, stated and, like, stated, like, without a blink. And later that night, she came by with a piece of her birthday cake. I remember to the back door, my mom was like, you can keep your cake. So for me, these attitudes, these beliefs aren't something that ever died down or ever went away or weren't visible. You know, I grew up being called nigger. Like, this is not new. And so I think the surprise kind of reveals the depths to which we've deluded ourselves, you know, and the depths to which we've kind of, like, denied kind of who we are as a country.
So when you have a friend growing up whose father is a member of the Klan, is that something...
Grandfather, yeah.
Grandfather. Is that something you can talk about with her? Or was that something that was, like, off, you know, like, you could not actually bring that up and discuss it?
Well, I would just say, like, oh, well, why can't I, you know, so in terms of our play, like, she would always come to my backyard and play. So she could come to my house to play, but never inside, like, only in the yard. But I could never go even to her yard to play. And so it was, like, a known thing. And it was just kind of like, you know, my parents don't like black people, said with, like, a straight face and with this kind of matter-of-factness. And so that's something that I think kind of sits with you and is one of the things that struck me in this story about this friendship. Because for the longest time, I questioned friendship and what was possible and whether or not, like you could be friends with someone who is white and that they would really be your friend, you know, throughout, you know, everything. Or they'd be friends in school where you'd play in school, but if you saw them at the grocery store with their parents, they'd pretend like not to know you. And so like that was real. And so those kind of things, I think, sink into your psyche and kind of like draw these very real lines in like interactions and in relationships. And, you know, even when like no one's calling you a name, like these experiences are the evidence.
So you're directing this movie that's set in the Mississippi Delta, but you grew up in, I think, a suburb of Nashville. You've lived for many years in Brooklyn. So, you know, you're a city and suburb person largely, but now you really had to immerse yourself in country life to understand the characters and the setting of the film. There's a scene that's a voiceover about the violence of day-to-day country life. And the Carey Mulligan character is stuck on this like dirt farm, and she used to live in a city, and she doesn't really want to be on this farm, but that's where her husband insisted on moving the family. And she's reflecting on the violence of country life. And this happens just after, in the African American family, the father has had to shoot the mule because the mule was dying and is lame and can't. You know, it's the humane thing to do.
Violence is part and parcel of country life. You're forever being assailed by dead things. Dead mice, dead rabbits, dead possums. You find them in the yard. You smell them rotten under the house. And then they're the creatures you kill for food. Chickens, hogs, deer, frogs, squirrels, pluck, skin, disembowel, debone, fry, eat, start again, kill. I learned how to stitch up a bleeding wound, load and fire a shotgun, reach into the womb of a heaving sow to deliver a breech piglet. My hands did these things, but I was never easy in my mind.
So, Dee Reese, what did you have to do to get on that mindset of that kind of violence of country life?
Yeah, so this passage was one of my favorite from Hillary's book because it sets such a tone for the world, as you mentioned, like the easiness of death. I'm looking at the indifference of nature where, you know, it seems that nature's working against them, but in fact, it's just that nature is indifferent to them.
I know one of your grandmothers, or maybe it was your great-grandmother, kept a journal. Tell me who it was, and also if you were able to use anything from there to help you understand the characters you were writing about and the era you were writing about.
Absolutely. So my grandmother's name is Ernestine Smith. She was born in 1925 in Faraday, Louisiana. And she wrote this journal or this unpublished book about, you know, her life growing up. She wrote about her parents picking cotton, my great-grandmother, Fami. And so she would tell me stories about how she and her little brother, Clarence, would ride on her mother's cotton sack and how she herself, you know, vowed she would never pick cotton. She didn't want to chop cotton. She wouldn't work as a domestic worker. She wanted to be a stenographer.
So with your grandmother, like her grandparents would have been slaves, right?
Exactly, yes. And there's pictures of them. So I have this picture of them, Emma and Bill. And the photograph I have of them is actually taken from a larger photo of a plantation of like a group of slaves. So every family stood in their family group and had this picture. And then everyone cut out the square that had their members in it. So the picture I have of them is like an excerpt from a larger picture. So it's just a square with just their faces in it.
Not everybody has photographs or writing or anything that dates back that far. You know, like several generations back. What does it mean to you to have that evidence of your family's past?
It's invaluable to have it. Like, my grandmother's a very meticulous, you know, organized person, you know, and the fact that she, you know, even, you know, took the time to sit down and, like, not just write, but, like, type out her experiences. There's, like, anecdotes about going to the market truck or anecdotes about funerals or people being sick. And, like, there's some pages that's, like, they're, like, biblical. It's, like, you know, it's, like, these begats or who had who and, you know, how they looked. And she gives, like, physical descriptions and demeanors. And it's amazing to have it. And it gives me a sense of connectedness.
So, you know, and in the movie, family and home are not necessarily safe places. In the African-American family, it's not a safe place because of the location, because it's Mississippi, and because, you know, there's so much racism. There are very strict limitations in terms of what they're allowed to do with their lives and what kind of relationships they're allowed to have, where they're allowed to go. And in the white family, the family isn't a safe place because, you know, the grandfather is really a monster. And in terms of Carey Mulligan's character, her husband, you know, he's the husband, so he's going to tell her what to do. And even though she's wiser than he is, she has to take orders from him. So, I mean, family and home are not safe. It seems to be a theme for you because in Pariah, you know, your earlier film, it's about a 17-year-old girl who's figuring out that she's a lesbian and is trying to figure out how, like, what does that mean and who is she and does she tell her parents? And if so, how does she tell them? And they're not going to be happy about it. And she's going to have to leave home to become who she is. So it seems to be a theme in your work. Was that a theme in your early life that you had to leave home to become yourself?
Yeah, I think for me, as someone growing up, you know, in like Antioch, Tennessee, I definitely felt the desire to, like, I definitely knew there wasn't elsewhere. I definitely knew that, like, if I were going to be free, I needed to be away from kind of like Nashville and kind of get out of the South and get out of the country. And even though, when I first went to school, I was in Florida, I just knew that I didn't want to go to college in the same place I grew up. I knew that expansiveness was necessary. Like, I think, like as a teenager, I did a program. There's like this thing called the LEAD program in business because I was going to go into business. So, and you could apply to which school you wanted to do this kind of like summer program at. And so I put down Columbia University as the place I wanted to go. And so, you know, junior high, like I had got to go to Columbia University and spend a summer there in New York City. And like I knew from that moment on, like New York City was a place where I could be. Like New York City is a place you can be yourself completely. And, you know, as long as it's authentic, like it's kind of like no questions asked. And so that's definitely something I felt like as a teenager and wanted to get away. And I don't know, I just think getting away from home is just helpful.
So you've said that when you made Pariah, your film about the 17-year-old girl who's realizing that she's a lesbian, that you were imagining what it would have been like had you come out earlier. Because you were in your 20s, I think, when you came out.
Mm-hmm.
What got you thinking about that? What it would have been like had you come out when you were 17?
I think it was living in Brooklyn and seeing it, you know. So I came out. It was like my second year of film school. And so my parents were already freaked out that I'd quit my job and gone to film school. And then this double, like, you know, hit of like, and also, by the way, I love women. So I think they thought I was having a nervous breakdown and tried to have a couple of like interventions. And so for me, it was, and I remember just feeling like such guilt, you know, feeling like I'd hurt my parents, feeling like I'd like, you know, that I was like hurting them in some major way. And I was a grown person, like I wasn't living, you know, under their roof. I was paying my own bills, and so I was surprised at the magnitude of guilt like that I felt, and like just fear that I was doing the wrong thing. And so, you know, meanwhile, I'm living in Brooklyn where I'm seeing teenagers who not only like know who they are, but are actively being it. And I was just kind of amazed at their bravery, like amazed that they were able to like do this, you know, in any small degree. And so I figured out, wow, you know, if I, you know, like what would it have been like if I had come out earlier?
In the movie, the mother's Christian, and that has a lot to do with why she's so upset that her daughter is a lesbian. Are your parents Christian, and did that have to do with their initial reaction to you coming out?
They are, yeah, yeah. Which for me is the other thing I wanted to explore. Like, it's not these mutually exclusive things like sexuality and spirituality, because I would identify as a Christian, and I'm also a lesbian, you know. And so for my parents, it felt like a mutually exclusive thing. Like, oh well, you can't be Christian if you're this way, you know. So they had this very kind of like finite idea of spirituality and belief, and that didn't ring true for me. And so like I felt like, well, actually, like my grandmother, I remember like one Thanksgiving, because I had limited like my going home just to holidays. And so we're at Thanksgiving table. It's me and my mother and my grandmother. And so my grandmother, like, says the grace over the table. In her prayer, she says, "You're perfect the way you are. There's not one thing I would change about you." And my mom said, "Oh, well, there's one thing." And my grandmother said, "Nope, there's not one thing I would change about you." And, like, that moment on, I felt vindicated, like almost cried. Like I felt like she was telling me in that moment that she accepted me for who I am and that she loved me unconditionally. And in that same way, it's like she kind of led my mom around. Like my parents have come around where they love me unconditionally. And, you know, I understand that they still might, I do actually think they still struggle. I think there's like not a spirituality, but there's like a religiosity, you know, at least that tells them that I'm somehow in the wrong. And I think they probably have moments where that bothers them. But on the whole, you know, I feel loved and I feel like that they're dealing with their own kind of beliefs about it.
When you were 24, you changed your name from Denise to Dee.
That's not true, actually.
That's
my name
true?
Was never Denise. No, my name is DeAndrea and I never changed it. But Dee is my screen name.
Oh, okay. Why do you prefer Dee?
Just because it's a brand, right? It's branding. So like D is what my aunties always called me growing up. So it's like a thing that's always been with me. And for the purpose of filmmaking, it's like in the middle of film school, you know, instead of DeAndre Reese on the screen, D Reese, it's like pithier, it's androgynous, and it's easier handle to pick you up by. Like I would probably get far less press coverage as DeAndre Reese than as D Reese. And like when people can't pronounce something, they're less likely to engage with it. And so I feel like all my life I was teaching people how to say my name, how to say DeAndrea. And as I made the transition to being an artist, to being a filmmaker, I looked at this history of artists that changed their names. And like my grandmother had actually changed her name from like Auberstein to Ernestine. And so I kind of took it on as something that was available to me. Like you can name yourself. Audre Lorde took the Y off her name. So to me, it seemed like a noble thing that was possible and accessible and that I should, you know, shouldn't hesitate to do.
Dee Reese, thank you so much for talking with us.
Thanks for having me, Terry.